Hola, buenos días. Bienvenidos a un otro episodio de Django Chat. Soy Carlton Gibson y tengo con siempre mi amigo Will Vincent. Hola, Will.
Hola, Carlton.
¿Cómo estás? Bien, sí. Y tenemos... Hoy tenemos un invitado muy especial, José Badía. Hola, José, ¿cómo estás?
Hola, ¿cómo estamos?
Sí, muy bien, muy bien. Let's do the rest in English.
Yep.
José, we're thrilled to have you on. You and I have met a couple times, and I think I first became aware of you through your work with JWT, so Django REST Framework. So what's the, do you have a quick background on, obviously Carlton and I know about your work in Django, but what's the quick take on your involvement in the Django community?
So I spent some time building a product called Blimp. We were a small team building a project management software, and I remember our first MVP was actually built in Flask and like MongoDB. And after failing doing that right, we switched back to Django. It was like probably like Django 1.2. And so I spent at least like around 5 years working with Python and Django. So I had a chance to kind of help maintain Django REST Framework and kind of pick up helping maintaining other libraries like PyJWT. And like through that, I've worked on random other bits and pieces. And by far, Python keeps being my favorite community.
Yeah, well, we'll link in the show notes, but I remember seeing you gave, was it 2014 to DjangoCon, you gave a talk on JWTs, which I think was your first time at a Django conference. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I think that went well. I didn't actually give that talk anywhere else, probably like in another Python meetup, but not in a conference. What I most liked about that talk was how at that time visually explaining what a JSON Web Token is. I think I did a good job at that. And kind of tying that up to authentication with like Django REST Framework and Django.
You know, I have to say, Jose, because you were working on Django REST Framework for just ages and ages and years. We were there, and you were an absolute machine maintaining the framework. You know, I mean, maybe you're doing it part of your work. You know, so you had the time, but you were there. You know, making the fixes, doing the updates. You know, absolute rock for years.
Thank you. That means a lot coming from you, definitely. And I don't, like, looking back, I think what I contributed the most at that time was kind of the story around third-party extensions. And, you know, how that story fits into Django REST Framework and Django and, you know, the whole Python community as a whole. It was definitely not part of my job. It's just free time kind of thing.
Right, okay.
But I definitely was glad I was able to help out with things like that.
Yeah, no, and you would, you know, absolute stalwart. But that's an interesting point you made about the third-party extensions, because it's something that in Django REST Framework we were really keen on and still are keen on, because we have very limited time and limited bandwidth to maintain stuff. And so someone comes along with a new feature idea, and it's like, well, first of all, can we put that into a third-party package that contributor can maintain themselves? Because that keeps the core maintainable, right?
Yep.
So what was Blimp? What was the quick take on that, what that service was?
So we were kind of three people working on that project, and we got together one day and we were just thinking of like things we could possibly build a product around. We had all worked in kind of digital agencies and marketing firms and things like that, where mostly they were using Basecamp, like first version of Basecamp at that point. So we had like really strong opinions about how project management should look like and should work like, especially in that creative environment, small teams. So we proposed a structured kind of process through product management. So we had a really nice like niche. We were targeting small teams like ours, 3, 4, 5 people. Most work was around the actual tasks. So we, you know, Basecamp had messaging, and people would just do project management via messaging, which is via email. We kind of forced you to use our proposed flow. And then, you know, at some point, Trello came up, Asana came up, and, right. you know, they were way bigger than us. And eventually, like, it made sense for us to just shut it down and focus on other things.
Right. Okay. What was the run there? Because, like, that was, you know, 5-year period, you say?
Yeah, like at least 5-6.
But that's a good run, right? For a startup that you've, you know, a small team that you're self running your own show.
We didn't take money. It was completely bootstrapped. We, you know, got together and made it happen. We learned a lot through the way, you know, through the whole period. And there were definitely, like, really good opportunities for other things to pop up. One of them being this side project I still maintain called File Previews.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about, or you and I have spoken about it, but I think it's a really interesting project. So what's the quick take on it? And then we can dive into the tech stack, because that's interesting.
So we were building at Blimp, we had like a file section, and you could upload files, right, to share them. And you could upload revisions to the files. And once we designed the whole thing, we noticed that we were kind of missing pretty thumbnails for files. So we, you know, if you upload a JPEG or a PNG, that's easy. If you upload like a Word document, that's a little bit harder. If you upload a Photoshop file or Illustrator file, that becomes harder. So we kind of built this pipeline where you could upload basically any kind of file, and we would just output some PNGs. And that was harder than it sounds. So we, like, from the first, from the get-go, we kind of built that separate to Blimp as a separate service. And we, like, after we built it and we were using it, we noticed that we could just put a landing page on it, put a pay button in it, and other people might buy it. And surprisingly, it outlived Blimp as a product.
Right.
It's been going on. And I kind of took over it after we decided to shut down Blimp, the product.
That's great, because that's like the original microservice, right? It's
five years
before the book, 5 years before the meme. It's like, yeah, it's a microservice.
And so what's the tech stack? How much can you tell us about the architecture of it?
So it's built with Django, obviously. It does have a simple API, so that's Django's framework. You know, we use Celery pretty extensively. We are using Redis as our broker, Postgres as our database. We host our workers on pretty hefty EC2 instances.
Yeah.
And our API is actually still in Heroku. It gives me an opportunity. I don't work with Python on my day-to-day job for a while now. And it gives you an opportunity to actually be in tuned with, you know, what's going on with Python and Django. But it also gives me a chance to kind of polish my scaling skills. So we have, you know, this is pretty CPU intensive work. And we have pretty interesting traffic patterns. So it, you know, I have to think about how we scale this, how we improve our availability, how, you know, I make sure we have monitoring and observability up to par.
Yeah, because I can imagine that you could, and maybe do, get a big client just comes in and crushes you with, how does the traffic look? Is that common that out of the blue you'll just get nailed with a lot of stuff and then otherwise it's flat, or is there any consistency there?
So we, you know, File Previews has customers around the world and different kind of traffic patterns. So we have people doing like bulk imports of just files that they have. So sometimes we'll get, you know, 5,000 requests one after the other to generate previews for different kinds of files. And, you know, I guess part of the challenge is, you know, you'd handle that with scaling your instances. So you have more instances and you can kind of, you know, process the queue faster. But things like larger files. So, you know, we have customers that sometimes upload a PDF file that is like 20,000 pixels by 30,000 pixels, right? And it's kind of like a PDF, it's like a giant PDF. So, you know, those are, one of those could be, you know, could hold up the queue for a longer time. So like, you know, we need to kind of be observing our limits, time limits, memory limits, CPU limits, file size limits.
Would this be a good example of a use case for serverless, like, you know, a Lambda or a functions-based approach? Or, you know, because that kind of looks like the perfect example, right? You've got discrete jobs that can be done one by one. Would it work in that environment? Or
Yes. So that, I'm hoping to be able to try that. Lambda, like AWS Lambda, they have some limits to the, you know, the size of what you can actually install there. So, you know, we, even though our workers run in a Docker container, you could imagine that Docker container is just like a VM. It'll be interesting to kind of split that into, to be able to just fit into whatever the constraint for Lambda is. But it should definitely be possible. At this point, you know, this is kind of my side project, and I haven't had the time. I tried porting
the internal story.
I tried porting a specific part of the pipeline, and it just was so like an additional complexity, like with testing and just like kind of how we would compile different dependencies that would fit into that particular environment. But yeah, it definitely seems like the thing that you could probably kind of model in that serverless like architecture.
Right. Okay. Interesting. But it's not, you know, so there's two parts. One, yes, but the other, no, is that, hang on, you know, the VM does, it gives me a lot here. I've got this whole structure.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time kind of tuning, or, you know, what we have to a particular infrastructure model, and that has solved our immediate scaling issues. So I am not, you know, touching that much of it now.
Can I ask, currently you're working at Auth0, is that right?
Yes, I do. I started working at Auth0 as an engineer in August.
Okay, so in an earlier episode, we were talking about authentication, and I sort of said, I gave Auth0 a go, and it didn't really fit in with Django, and so, you know, I probably wouldn't use it, and I don't know, what's the use case? So here, can I ask you to put your Auth0 hat on and tell us the Auth0 story for Django?
You're wearing the sweatshirt.
can you tell, so if I'm going to use Auth0 in my Django project, or I'm going to consider it, can you just give us the sales pitch? What does it give me as a Django developer?
Okay, so kind of going back to that episode where, you know, you were talking about authentication and authorization, you kind of defined those, and I think you did a very good job. And I guess one question I, as a developer of like indie small side projects using Django, I often question myself, like, why would I use Auth0 versus something like Django OAuth, right? And if we kind of think about Django's batteries included philosophy, you know, Django does a really great work at not letting developers screw up authentication, right? There's a configurable password hashing system with really great defaults. So you don't have to think about using Bcrypt or do I use like MD5 or, you know, it's really hard to even store like plain text passwords. And then there's this other like whole other things that third party packages kind of help with, like password strength checks and throttling, authenticating against like third party identity providers like Facebook or Google. But you, the developer, you still need to think about those security related things. You need to kind of know that you're looking for throttling of your login endpoints, and you need to install a package. After you find it, you need to configure, you need to maintain that, and whatever other kind of dependencies that might have, you might need to have a Redis server or something else, right? So Auth0 provides authentication and authorization as a service. We give developers and companies building blocks to secure their applications without having to become security experts. You know, we provide unified device agnostic login experience. So it doesn't matter if you're working on a web app or a mobile app, you can still provide this unified login experience that looks like one single thing, right? We provide like many social identity providers. You can add custom ones too, brute force protection, breach password detection, single sign-on, passwordless login, multi-factor auth, user management. And, you know, these are all the things that you could probably find if something like Django or Django All App can't provide. You can go and find possibly a third-party package that somebody built.
Yep.
You then need to actually assess if they're, you know, well-maintained, if they're well-built, if they're secure. And then we go back to that, you know, security expert thing. Auth0 also does something really cool, which they allow you to write custom JavaScript code to customize any part of the authentication and authorization flow. So, for example, if you wanted to enrich user profiles from data from, like, Clearbit, if you wanted to reuse information from, you know, another database or service, if you wanted to, I don't know, notify another system of like real-time logins, you can do that. So it goes back to like, is you can, you, Django provides you login out of the box, and you could figure out the whole template situation and set yourself. And, you know, going back to like one of the recent episodes, we were talking about patterns, and you, after you built, you know, one, two apps that have login, you'll notice the patterns and you'll maybe have your own project templates. And, you know, but then this other, like, little thousands of other things around authentication, authorization, and security, you either need to be aware of, be proactive, or you'll have to be reactive after a possible incident. So either, you know, you kind of delegate all those really important security and trust aspects of your application to somebody like Auth0, or, you know, you take that on and you need to be aware of, you know, what taking that on means.
Okay. That's a super answer. And so one thing you mentioned at the beginning of that, so two thoughts that came up. One was you mentioned about the side project versus the big, you know, it's a side project. Yeah, totally. I can see why you take it on. But Auth0 surely pitches itself for big projects too, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's not just for a developer side. So
yeah, so it's not only for, you know, somebody building a web app and a mobile app. We are an identity platform, right? So if you're building a single sign-on for your whole, like, internal infrastructure services on a large enterprise setting, Auth0 would still, you know, work for you.
Fine. And okay. And then when the second thought was, when I tried this a long time ago, is when Auth0 first came out and I gave it a go and I gave it a spin, I didn't really find that it integrated with Django in the way I wanted to, in that it would do the JWT client-side authentication. I could see how that would give me the mobile app authentication. That was all super. But what I really wanted was, in my view, request.user to return an instance. So is there now a nice story about integrating with the Django project? Like remote user backend.
Yep. So we have, I feel like one of the things that attracted me to Auth0 a long time ago was their content as a marketing effort. And, you know, they have really great guides. So I was just checking out the getting started guide with Django. And since Auth0 actually provides an Auth2 API, you can use something like Django Social Auth or Django All Auth, and you would use Auth0 as an identity, right? And then you would handle, in Auth0, you would handle Facebook login.
Super.
And whatever. So I, you know, part of the Quickstart guide I was looking at does use remote user backend on the remote user middleware. It really fits into the whole Django lingo.
Okay, that sounds super. So I think, can you, in the show notes, we can put a link to those getting started guides with Django.
Definitely.
Yeah?
Well, and I wanted to ask you too. So I saw on Twitter, I think just yesterday, there was just the North Bay Python Conference, and Guido tweeted this thing about Jacob Kaplan-Moss, Django co-creator, saying, stop using passwords, use login with Google, Facebook. Quote, Google's security team is better than yours. I have some, I'm honestly, my jaw dropped when I saw that, but I'm curious what your thoughts are as much more of a expert in this realm than I am. I just don't even know where they're coming from with that. You know, I mean, Facebook was storing stuff in clear text. I mean, I can see Auth0, but to just hand it over to, you know, one of the couple monopolies, to me, I just, I don't know how you feel, Carlton.
There's two parts.
I feel like I'm missing something big here.
If this is just a side weekend project, then, you know, absolutely, the more you can outsource, the best. But if this is, if, you know, if your user database is a core strategic asset of your business, then you can't just hand it over to a third party. So there's that point, which is important. And yeah, are Facebook that secure? Because every time I turn on the news, it's...
it's so crufty and creepy. I mean, Google's not much better. I mean, that's, I actually, I mean, so with Django Auth0, which is fantastic, I think I still have the, you know, top Google spot for a tutorial on that. And I actually deliberately don't, I think there's one, maybe I showed Gmail, but I don't show Facebook because, well, here I go, never working at Facebook. I think Facebook is pretty awful. So I don't feel like doing their job for them. But we got off on a little bit of a rant. So make the case for Auth0 as opposed to like Google, Facebook. If someone just says, well, I'm just delegating my auth in either case, why is that actually incorrect?
This is interesting. So like, I think one thing to notice is that you can use all auth, I mean, sorry, Auth0 without integrating any like social identity providers, right? You don't need to use Facebook or Google or, you know, the other 300 providers that we might have. You can use like email and password against the Auth0 database, right? Yeah, I think like trust is the name of the game. It's especially when you're handling such an important path for an application as authentication is and as authorization is.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a deep topic. I mean, one part of this, which I've seen with some services recently, is this login by email where there is no password. Every time I log in, I just put in my email address and I get a one-time link. You know, that's, I can see how that's more secure. It's maybe a little annoying, but I'm seeing that more and more.
Yeah, that's.
But as well, you've got to bear in mind as well that a lot of people struggle with passwords. And if you can send them a link where they get a button and they can click it, that's, or, you know, tap it these days, that's actually a much better user flow. So it's arguably more secure, probably is. And, you know, assuming the email's not compromised, but the email's the sort of golden key to all of this, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's like passwordless login, and that's something that Auth0 also allows you to do pretty easily. And, you know, we since we also provide like MFA, so you can do like multi-factor authentication,
yeah.
You can use like the Google Authenticator or Auth0 or if you have to, well, you can use SMS. And I think now that we're starting to see 2FA become like something normal, it's like, I wouldn't say it's like, I can't get my parents to use like 2FA. And so then you can't like make that a hard requirement, right? So I can see like passwordless login, not depending on your target. As a UX standpoint, it might actually like hurt your user experience. I can't imagine my mom, you know, putting in her email if she remembers which email to use, and then like, why do I have to go to my email? And like, I found the email now. What? Oh, there's a link. So like, again, it's like it depends on your target. I can see now that, you know, there's a lot of players kind of working to improve the whole like, user story for security. Like if you think about security keys, like hardware keys, passwordless login, MFA, and things like that. So I'm hoping that in the you know, coming years, we'll have a better story for all of this.
I think Django needs a better story as well. We don't have the two-factor auth built in yet, and we don't even, it's not, we haven't yet got the, even like the hooks where you would add that really. There are a couple of third-party mm-hmm. solutions, but they're not, you know, they need to be brought into Django. I think it's part of the batteries that now that you need to be able to plug into two-factor.
Yeah. I recently, so I love the, you know, Django admin, and I never turn it off. So for file previews, I've had to kind of work around things like pagination, because, like, you know, at our rate, most things don't work in the Django admin. But like, once you get through that hurdle, it's like, okay, so now how do I hide the admin login? Because I already have like this whole other login flow that I want to use and kind of funnel all traffic, if you know, if it's for our regular users or for our admin super users. And yeah, that's, it's been a little bit clunky on that side.
The way I do that, which
I don't quite understand that. I was just going to ask, so are you giving admin access to some users can see their previews in there? It sounds like there's three levels.
No, it's just me at this point.
Okay. So what I do in that situation is I use Nginx to lock it down to localhost, and then just SSH into the box that it's, and connect via a tunnel.
Yeah, and then if you're using Heroku, that becomes like a harder.
Oh thing. Yeah, okay. Heroku's a different. Uh-huh. But like the reason I do that is because then it's not exposed on a, you know, URL and.
Yep, and like, you know, most logins out there don't even have rate limiting or throttling, so you can do like credential stuffing attacks and you would probably, you don't even notice.
Yeah.
I wonder just for Auth0, from the marketing aspect, you know, all of this stuff sounds, the more you learn about the web, the more you go, oh my God, how scary it is. But it's, you know, but a beginner just, you know, wants it to work and has trouble with that. So I wonder, at what point does someone go, wow, I really need to switch over to Auth0? Is it, do they already get burned, or they're at a big company where the login is complicated? It feels like you almost need to get burned or be in a large enough, complicated enough organization before you go, oh, wow, maybe I want some help with this.
Yep. I think right now it's kind of, you know, reactive. You've had a bad experience.
Right.
You've had a leak. You've had, you know, security vulnerabilities being reported to you. And I think one of the other like great things that Auth0 does well is, again, this is probably a marketing strategy, is, you know, putting out content that is relevant on security topics and best practices, mm-hmm. and kind of like teaching the general audience about security, and hoping that we're going to start seeing people be more proactive about this, and, you know, not having to wait to actually be on a bad position after an incident, and then, you know, having to figure, oh, maybe we should have use an identity provider, and, you know, 3 years in with millions of users, that might be a harder thing, but still possible.
Right. No, I think they have the fantastic guides on, I remember just JWTs when I was learning about that. And I mean, it's similar to what DigitalOcean has done, I think, to differentiate themselves. They have fantastic content because, you know, spinning stuff up is scary for beginners. Though it does seem to me, just from a business aspect, that at the end of the day, you know, beginners are kind of whatever. It's all about big clients. I mean, this is what I have to keep reminding myself, because even Heroku, like I have Heroku in my books, and I mean, almost every day I get some sort of question around Heroku or SendGrid, you know, Twilio. And I'm just like, why can't they be bothered to make this, you know, friendly? And it's because they don't, I think it's because they don't really care, right? I mean, a couple newcomers isn't the same as having really good, you know, docs as opposed to tutorials that an experienced developer at a large company can just dive in and use.
Yeah.
That's the thesis I have now. I don't know.
I can't speak to, you know, Auth0 or Twilio or DigitalOcean stuff, but having worked on file previews, you know, after some time, I've decided to cater to a specific target of users. mostly because I don't have the bandwidth to deal with a lot of like incoming beginner level leads, right? At the end of the day, they'll unfortunately require a little bit more time and kind of like not hand holding, but you know, explaining what a webhook is and things like that. And in my experience, kind of converting that, you know, all that invested time and resources into converting that specific user to a paying customer, you know, the ROI is way less. So I'm kind of vague in some parts. I'm kind of vague in like some of the pricing, vague in kind of like some of the examples that we put out. And that, for me, that has worked. So I can definitely speak to like.
But I think that's a standard story from SaaS businesses, right? It's the few big enterprise clients, the one where you're off the end of the pricing thing and it's call us for a quote. That's where all the profit comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm slow coming to this realization, but it sort of makes sense because I've always wondered. What is the stack at Auth0? Because you mentioned you're not using Python there. What sort of technologies are you using day to day?
So it's mostly Node.js, like from the ground up. Main core services have been built in Node.js, and we have tons of people that are very experienced in how to make Node scale. There are some services that are built with like Java and Go. There's some Python, I think, but it's like for some like ops related things.
Ask you, switch over to async. Just do a total rewrite, no big deal.
Yeah, I'm currently so when I joined the kind of the platform domain, so we are like the, you know, backbone of trust for, you know, our customers, but we kind of enable other developers in Auth0 to, you know, be able to be as productive as they can be. So I'm working on our untrusted code execution platform. So we basically all this code that our customers can write in JavaScript to extend like different flows of authentication authorization. We basically execute their code and kind of inject the results in different parts of the flow.
Yeah, no, that's a great problem though. Like, because hey, give me some code. I'm not going to know what it is, and I'm going to run it on my computer. Like that's a tricky problem, no?
Yeah, doing that at scale seems hard. I'm really excited. Like I've been here for, I don't know, a couple of months now, and I've learned so much from like so many smart people. And you know, coming from a small kind of consulting and small products, the experience I've kind of gained, you know, doing things at this scale is amazing. And that's, you know, kind of why I wanted to switch after all these years, you know, doing the entrepreneur thing.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, and are they, and this may be an ignorant question, but so it's Node, so are they using, you know, for the web stuff, is it Express? I mean, I know the web part is just a teeny piece of it, but what is beyond Node? What is the stack? I mean, I know it's hard to define in such a big organization.
There's some Express and there's some Happy, Happy.js.
And Happy is a kind of batteries included web framework or API framework, right? It's got it provides things like Joy for the validation and the back end, that the authentication back ends, these kind of things. You don't have to go looking for them in micro
packages. It's definitely a little more than Express, way less than Django. Okay. I think that there's like work on standardization around, you know, which one should we use when. That's all I know.
Well, I know that Brave browser, which actually I use, which is Brendan Eich involved with. Yeah, they're big on the Happy train.
Yep, and
pretty good stamp of a.
Auth0 also they sponsor a lot of open source projects around authentication, identity. You know, so before I even joined Auth0, they reached out to me one day and they, you know, asked me if I wanted kind of them to sponsor the PyJWT library. And that's amazing. And I, you know, learned that they do that with many other libraries. So they're actually, you know, we use these libraries internally, and even if we don't use them, the fact that there are other developers working on this, they care about that.
That's really good.
Yeah, well, I like that they're doing the positive education approach as opposed to the fear approach, probably because fear is, you can't fear something you don't understand. Because certainly, you know, as a parent, I look at all the ads, they're all like, your kid might die, or you're a bad parent. Like, they're pretty unsubtle about it for, you know, a car seat or a car. So I appreciate them having that approach. I did want to ask, we're coming up on time. I think you just gave a talk at PyGotham, right? On is that out yet? Can we link to that?
Yes, I can definitely add that to the show notes.
Can you talk about that?
So it's called Python Government and Contracts. It's a talk I gave on I think September at PyGotham, and actually my partner in crime, Froilan Irisarri, he gave a version of that talk at North Bay Python.
And
that recording is also out. After Hurricane Maria passed through Puerto Rico, I was not in Puerto Rico at that time. I spent weeks, if not months, without hearing from my parents. Due to infrastructure issues, that power was out, cell phone antennas were out, water, was out. and so that kind of leads to some kind of questionable contracts that were awarded to companies to kind of, supposedly rebuild infrastructure in Puerto Rico and kind of help after the destruction. The FEMA was involved in some of that. And that leads to I kind of learning about the Office of the Comptroller in Puerto Rico. They put out the contracts that government agencies award to other contractors. And kind of sometime after that, I had some questions as a civilian. I am not a investigative journalist or anything like that, but I did have some questions about, how money was being spent in particular agencies. And I kind of wanted to see, relations between, different contractors doing business as other, companies. So I basically built a project together with Froilan, where we kind of took the data, we kind of pulled and downloaded all this data from the Office of the Comptroller's website. We downloaded the actual PDF documents for the contract, and we're kind of extracting text from, kind of things that I've learned doing file previews. We're extracting that text, we're indexing that data, so now it can be searched and correlated. So this is kind of like a civic hacking project that I'm very passionate about. I've been working on it for on and off for almost a year. And finally this year we decided to kind of talk about it because we thought it would be an interesting story about kind of how we went about it. This is open source. It's built in Django, Django-REST framework, Postgres. Our front end is like Next.js. I'm definitely very, very excited to keep talking about this. We're at a point where we're talking about how we can be more transparent about how this is financially sustainable. It does cost some money to run, not that much. So we want to be transparent about that and see if we need help from others. I'm finally like excited to see where this goes. I want to empower other people like me to kind of know what questions to make and kind of be able to visualize and at the end of the day, just hold accountable whoever needs to be held accountable.
These kind of things, you always see this, you know, billions of dollars being budgeted for rebuilding, and yet somehow on the ground, the stuff wasn't rebuilt. And well, where's that money gone? And all it takes is the light to be shone on where that money goes, and it will be spent in the right places. Whereas when there's darkness, it goes into people's pockets. So that's super.
I mean, and this would seem like the reason we talk about Hurricane Maria and how that leads up to this, and even after, you know, 2+ years after that happening, is that, you know, recently the FBI arrested a FEMA employee and the CEO of one of the companies involved in one of these contracts. So this is still relevant today, and there's ongoing investigations to multiple, you know. Some politician has a daughter working for, you know, $10,000 a month in some like unrelated thing in the government. And now we're starting to see this things like popping up. And it's like, yes, we're fighting against like corruption.
Super.
Well, do you know if any of these federal agencies are using your work to help in their investigations, or do they have their own tools? How does...
So I don't think so. At the end of the day, the actual contract, they are available via the Office of the Comptroller. I do know that, you know, there is like some, I don't know, journalists kind of using this tool instead of the Comptroller's tool, just because it sucks less. And it's, you know, you get some insights, even at the simplest level, you get some insights of spending over time, and just doing, you know, correlation between, you know, I don't know, a contractor being entered into a system with a typo, and you can still kind of search through that and see, oh, you know, these two contractors are the same entity. And they've been awarded this amount of money, and you can see the actual PDF there without having to download it. So at the end, I wouldn't have wanted to build something like this. I would have wanted the tool put out by the Office of the Comptroller to be this.
Yes.
But I'm happy to have done it. I spent a lot of time, like, you know, kind of figuring out how to gather this data. It's definitely not open data. It's on their site somehow, and I managed to just download it very slowly and make it happen. If now I can like empower, I don't know, some data scientists to build cool visualizations on something else that I don't know, like, I don't know, spending by a particular geographic location by fiscal year or something like that, they can now do that without having to spend all this time and effort into actually gathering the data.
Super.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, because I, to make this about me, I spent 2 years of my life on a project with school data in the United States, where every state has all this reporting data on these various tests that everyone has to take at third, eighth grade, high school, all these types of things. And I probably just got a teeny glimpse of what you had, where it's just a nightmare getting this information. I mean, first of all, you know, some states had it online. You could just download the CSV files, you know, like Massachusetts, California. Some states, you know, it was like a PDF. I think it was Kansas who said I had to file a Freedom of Information Act request to get a CD with the data. And it's just, I guess it's a combination of nobody has the ability and impetus to actually pull all these things together. And you realize how futile all these government agencies are, where they're just checking their box. And it's like, no, it doesn't even occur to anyone to use it for these broader, like, well, what if we wanted to analyze the data? What if we wanted to use it for something? They spend millions and tens of millions collecting it, and then it just goes away.
But there's something deeply sinister than that, is that there are institutional biases against making the data openly available, because people in positions of power have a vested interest in keeping it quiet.
Sure.
And so it's important that people like Jose do the civil society stuff to bring it out into the light and call them to account. That's how democracy is maintained. That's how I'm welling up.
Yeah, well, and that's one thing I love about Django is it's, I think, unusual. It's roots in journalism and investigative journalism, from the beginning, right? I mean, Jacob worked at 18F. I mean, Simon's on a fellowship at Stanford on this. I mean, I kind of love that, you know, non-pure tech background of Django, whereas you said you wanted an easy way to display this data, and the Django part didn't stand in your way. It was the collection and all the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I keep going back to, you know, Django, because I hate reinventing the wheel. I just want to get things done. And so it's, you know, I have a project template that kind of has some of my preference mixed into it, and I feel so comfortable.
Yeah, no, I use that. It's one of my favorites. I'm always following the updates.
Wait, you don't use mine, Carlton?
No, yours is fine, but I use Jose's, okay?
Sorry.
Competing over free tools, yeah.
Yeah, so it goes back to not having to reinvent the wheel all the time. Like, I just want to make things and do it fast and, you know, kind of get out the door as fast as possible. And, you know, Django and Python are the things to do that.
As we wrap up, are any plugs you want to make for us? So you have a personal site, jpedia.com, which we'll link to. Anything around side projects or Auth0 you want to mention as we head out the door?
So, I mean, Auth0 is always hiring. So I'll plug that link in the show notes. You know, I'll also link to that PyGotham talk. It's something I'm really passionate about. I also set up my kind of sponsorship profile on GitHub, so I could maybe link to that. I'm hoping to kind of get back in track with some of the projects that I'm working on that I know I've kind of over time let, you know, kind of sit away and be unmaintained. And I kind of feel really bad about that because, you know, people actually use them. So I'm hoping to, you know, start spending some more of my free time kind of getting them back to date, especially like dropping Python 2 support.
Right. But let me just say that you mustn't feel guilty, because the time that you give to open source is phenomenal, and it has been phenomenal over a massively sustained period of time. You've got a life, you've got family, you've got work, you've got other commitments. The guilt is not necessary. Your work stands on its own.
Thank you.
Right. Well, again, I'm so pleased we could have you on.
My pleasure.
It's a great thrill for me. A great thrill for me to meet you in person, you know, a year ago. So yeah, we'll put links to everything. Thanks again. Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Gracias for coming on.
Ciao.
Ciao.